Your Honor, my name is James Egan, and I am the attorney for this young boy who, with the court's permission, I would like to refer to him by his first name. That would be acceptable to the court. Thank you. Your Honor, I think that this case ultimately is about two things: procedural due process and fundamental fairness. I believe it was Felix Frankfurter that said that procedure is to law what the scientific method is to science. And like the scientific method, procedure is essential for ensuring that we have confidence in the result, that we have confidence that the result that's been obtained or achieved is in fact the correct one and the just one. Now, the United States Supreme Court, in Kent v. United States, and also in Henry Gault, and this court, in State X Rel TJH v. Bills, and recently 4 years ago in State X Rel DC v. McShade, specifically and unequivocally said that there were at least three procedural due process requirements before you took a child out of the protections of the juvenile court and put him into a court of general jurisdiction. The first one, they said, you had to have a hearing. Second one is that you had to have effective representation by counsel. And the third is that you had to have a statement of reasons with reasonable support in the record. And in fact, the language in Kent, which I believe has been cited in other cases as well, the Supreme Court specifically said that there is no place in our system of law for removing a child from the protections of the juvenile jurisdiction without those three elements.
Counsel, one of the reasons we took this writ was because it was represented to us that the state did not agree that there was any right to effective assistance of counsel at this stage of the juvenile court proceedings and a certification hearing. But as I read the state's brief, I didn't get that at all.
Well, my understanding, Your Honor, I was asserting that in my petition, I alleged that there was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Right.
The state...
As I saw the state, they went right to the merits of it instead of disputing that...
Well, that's one of my points. I don't feel that the state has ever addressed my claims that there was ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, prejudice is one of those things, and they certainly address a lack of prejudice.
Well, I would respect to submit that they attempted to. I don't think that they did it satisfactorily, but obviously that's for this court.
I think Judge Limbaugh is trying to get to the preliminary issue that it appeared one of the issues that might occur on appeal was whether or not you're even entitled to effective assistance of counsel on a certification hearing. But the brief of the state seemed to assume, for the purposes of the argument, you were and say, but you got it. Is that an issue that we need to address in this case, or is that conceded? Well, we can talk to counsel for the state.
If I'm hearing you correctly, I believe it is conceded that I believe the state agrees that that Thomas was entitled to effective assistance of counsel.
But you're saying, regardless, you would say the Kent case says that you're entitled to effective assistance of counsel at this stage?
Yes, and I also think that the Bills and the McShane case say that as well.
And so why do you allege that he didn't receive effective assistance here and equally importantly was prejudiced by any ineffective assistance?
Well, Your Honor,
how would it have made a difference had counsel acted differently?
Okay. Well, Your Honor, there are two prongs. I applied the Strickland standard. I found no case law to suggest any other standard, mm-hmm. So I applied the Strickland standard and I went addressed it in two prongs. And so first prong is, did the competence and performance fall below that of a reasonably objective attorney? I think the Exhibit A, the deposition, clearly shows that the attorney did not...
Frankly, given the seriousness of the charge, I can't imagine any juvenile court judge anywhere not certifying this fellow.
Well, Your Honor, I appreciate the sentiment, but I would have to respectfully disagree because the law allows the juvenile court the discretion to keep a juvenile...
I know that.
I understand. Well, my point is that there are no laws that require a child to be certified. So, under our system, could be kept in the juvenile system.
Are you suggesting that the court did not consider the alternatives to certification?
No, I'm suggesting that the court never heard them.
Well,
But I think in your brief you talked about that the court thought that he might get out after a year and wasn't told that there were facilities he could stay in until 18 or even 21 if the court believed it, that those arguments weren't made and the Boys Town alternative and so forth were not presented to the court as possibilities.
Right, they were not presented, and that's why I feel...
Counsel, what I'm getting at is that every juvenile court judge knows already all of the alternatives that are provided by the Division of Youth Services. That's part of the job of the court. That's part of the... Yeah.
Are there things in the record that make you think the court might not have understood about because he hadn't been told about the available alternatives?
Yes, I do, and if you go back to the order doesn't specifically says in Judge Crawford's order, no evidence was presented.
Then why didn't you seek a writ on that order certification? By not seeking a writ on that, did the juvenile court lose its jurisdiction?
Well, my argument, Your Honor, is that you have to have, the order has to be effective, but that you also have to have the hearing and the effective assistance of counsel. They need all three before jurisdiction is transferred.
But couldn't you have argued those things in a writ challenging the order certification as opposed to now challenging the second amended objection to the information? Aren't you a little tardy?
Well, I challenged my understanding from In Re TJH that the first thing I need to do is file a motion and assert the court to dismiss, and that's what I did. That's the second amended objection to the information.
And the court held a hearing. The
yes.
Circuit court held a hearing, and the subject of the hearing was the effective assistance of counsel in the certification proceeding.
Yes, that was, well, there were actually two hearings, Your Honor, because as you recall, the second amended objection to the information, but also addressed constitutional issues with the statute, that was discussed on June 15th, and then on July 20th, that the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel was
And does, as your opponent argues, the fact that the circuit court specifically looked at, heard evidence on, and adjudicated whether or not there was effective assistance of counsel, does that not remove any prejudice from your claim of ineffective assistance of counsel in the certification proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, I would have to respectfully disagree because the reason is twofold. One, I respect the Smith that Judge Moten, and I'm really being critical of the judge, but I believe he misapplied the law. If you look at the docket entry from July 23rd, he said the court has carefully considered this evidence, and we feel that the result would be no different. I don't have to show that the result would be different. I have to show that there's a reasonable probability that the result would be different. So in that regard, I would say he misapplied the law. And even if he didn't misapply the law, I'm certainly not presuming to tell a judge what his duties are, but there was no analysis. There was no, he didn't take each or any of the specific claims of ineffective assistance and give any type of analysis.
Getting back to the basics, you have a right to counsel. For us to say, well, that could be ineffective assistance, doesn't that negate the right to counsel to say, well, it's okay, it doesn't really matter what the counsel's like, it's just you have a right to counsel and it can be ineffective and totally incompetent, but it really doesn't matter.
But
you're constitutionally allowed to right to counsel, right?
I believe that the right to counsel includes a right to effective assistance of counsel. And yes, there was an attorney, but I feel that it was very ineffective.
Can you address further the prejudice issue? You're saying that under the appropriate standard of reasonable probability, the result would be different. What is it on which you base your assertion that the trial court abused its discretion in not finding there was a reasonable probability the result would have been different?
Well, to begin with, Your Honor, the trial court heard, I respect the Smith, overwhelming and uncontroverted evidence. There was absolutely no evidence presented by the state, and in the McShane case, this court ruled that the evidence was overwhelming. But the attorney for the state did present at least some evidence that the board was confident. He was in ninth grade, he may have written some letters. In the hearing down in front of Judge Moten, there was no evidence that the state presented.
Let me just follow up on that just a little bit. I'm sorry to interrupt you. But in the transcript, there was the attorney for the child, Thomas, says, as his representative, as his lawyer, he says, If you think this, and this is trying to represent the client, I guess who's trying to say he wasn't trying to shoot anyone, it depends. The attorney for the juvenile says, if you think this is cool, get it the hell out of your mind right now. And who are you gutting for, kid? And then he explains this, he was just trying to get his client to talk. Now, I don't know how that's
represented. I respectfully submit that in that those two interrogations, what the attorney did is essentially abandoned his boy and became an agent of the state.
And in terms of the prejudice, you're saying that he made admissions because of and in response to the attempt by his counsel to get him to confess, in fact, that affected the result, or this all goes to competence. There's also the prejudice. Absent all the things that may have occurred because of the bad representation, would the result have been different? And I think you need to still do more to get to that answer.
I believe that effective counsel would not have had that statement be made. I think
besides the things that Judge Teitelman just referring to, I have to come back, I suppose, to Judge Limbaugh's question, and that is, I mean, this kid brought a gun to school and pointed at people.
Shot it.
Yeah, shot the gun and then pointed at the principal. It didn't shoot him, but so it's a very serious set of acts.
Absolutely.
And the question really for the trial court is, was there evidence that was not presented about this child's ability to be tried as an adult, or something of the nature of something that, if the judge fairly considered it, would be a reason not to have this person go forward into the adult courts?
Well, I guess where I'm stuck is I have to respectfully disagree with Judge Limbaugh's belief that the juvenile court judges know all of the available possibilities for juvenile.
Well, that's why I was referring to it as evidence. I mean, what evidence would there be produced? There was a psychologist something.
There would be a DYS representative who would specifically testify that the judge ordered the boy to be in residential treatment until he was 18. The court would have no choice but to follow that order.
Now, every juvenile court judge in the state knows that.
They may know that, Your Honor. I guess I just respectfully disagree that they know necessarily about Boys Town and Boys and Girls Town, Missouri. They didn't hear.
In my mind, that's no different from any trial court judge knowing the range of punishment for criminal offenses. I mean, that's.
I guess I don't know how to say that. If you go back to the order, Judge Crawford doesn't just say there's nothing available. Judge Crawford says no evidence was presented. I'm asking this court to send it back so that I can present that evidence, and then maybe the boy will still be certified.
Did I understand that the person who heads Boys Town said that indeed some juvenile courts had, I guess, left children in the juvenile system because they had people there who had brought guns to school, but nonetheless were sent to Boys Town, or someone said there was some evidence that they had been treated and had gone to Boys Town even when they brought weapons to school.
Mr. Hillier talked about how there wasn't a boy who had involving weapons and had shot the gun, and he was sent to Boys Town and he was kept as a juvenile and has been very successful.
One last question. In good judge Stitt's opinion, Roper versus Simmons, it was, and the Supreme Court affirmed, it was the situation where we said a 17-year-old did not have the mental capacity to have a capital punishment on them. Because is there anything about a 13-year-old or 15-year-old where did you present any evidence about a 13 or 15-year-old where they don't have the ability to manifest? Certainly like a 5-year-old or 6-year-old. Their statute does say 13 and up, but is there anything you have to go to illuminate that issue?
Well, I did present that in my second amended objection to information, and I had witnesses ready to testify about the nature of the juvenile brain and the diminished culpability, the lack of culpability, or the same culpability shouldn't be given to children as it is to adults. But Judge Moten would not let me put on that evidence in the view where he made me read from my brief or my motion.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. please the court. It is perhaps ironic that it was Judge Seiler, Justice Seiler, that last wrote an opinion of this court that dealt with certification issues of a juvenile, he being from Jasper County and me being from Jasper County, and this case arising from that. Perhaps also ironic that our current Chief Justice sits clerk for Justice Seiler. It is also ironic that I worked at the firm that Justice Seiler founded. Having said all that, there are two cases that...
And that was also somewhere about 25, 30 years ago.
That's exactly right. I wasn't going to mention that. it is perhaps ironic that both NRA TJH and TJH versus Bills had separate either dissenting or concurring opinions. The first was in NRA TJH, where Justice Seiler dissented, and that perhaps opened up the door for the TJH versus Bills decision in 1974, Your Honor. And in TJH versus Bills, the majority opinion was written by Justice Seiler, and Justice Donnelly dissented. And I would suggest to this court that had the majority of this court adopted Justice Donnelly's dissenting opinion, which was very succinct and very clear, in 1974, we would not be here today. However, we are here, and we're here to discuss the merits of both procedural merits and substantive merits.
We don't have any judges who clerk for Judge Donnelly on the court.
No, I couldn't find any, at least. So,
Counsel, you agree that there can be an actionable claim of ineffective assistance of counsel at a certification hearing. Don't you?
Your Honor, I think I have to agree. I do think that it's an interesting question because of the nature of a juvenile hearing being sort of a civil hearing that right. doesn't have all the protections of a criminal case. However, Kent versus United States essentially says, does say explicitly
that... Well, when is that claim to be litigated?
I'm sorry?
When is that claim to be litigated? The juvenile's ineffective assistance of counsel claim for the certification proceeding.
I think that since 1974, it is clear in TJH versus Bills that procedurally that can be litigated through a writ of prohibition immediately after the order is entered by the juvenile judge.
Okay, so this is the time and place to do it.
I think that the appellate court is the place, and I think the time is immediately after the order.
But, and there's
they
some
didn't do it here.
But it was not done.
But he cited a case where we had approved, apparently waiting and objecting in the circuit court, and normally people do raise that issue in the circuit court if they're certified, if they think it was incorrect. So would we have to overrule those cases holding to the contrary?
Your Honor, I think that that is the best approach. I think that Justice Donnelly, in his concurring opinion, essentially said the same thing, that the objection to the information stage, once you have granted the right to take an extraordinary writ of prohibition on that order, there is no need for the device set forth in Kent.
But whatever we're to do in our rules in the future, given that the procedure approved in our cases was followed here, if we were to go ahead and reach the merits because the approved procedure was followed, what would be your argument?
Thank you. The substantive issue is, did Judge Moten, under the procedure that was followed in this case, did Judge Moten abuse his discretion in objecting to the information? And I argue to this court that the judge did not abuse that discretion. The facts are clear, as has been pointed out. This is a boy who took an assault rifle into a school, fired it into the ceiling, pointed it at the principal of the school, and attempted to fire again.
Yeah, and a lot of the evidence that came out regarding his intent and what he did and pointing it at the principal and why he did so, if he had the intent, only came out after his own counsel said, you should talk, tell him, take responsibility, tell us why he did this, who were you gunning for, and directed his client to walk through the event with the prosecutor. Really a very unusual approach for defense counsel to take, I would think. Absent that, what is the evidence that would have been there?
Yes, Your Honor. Absent, the evidence still would exist, even absent any statement from the defendant, who may not testify at all, given his constitutional rights to not testify against himself. The evidence would be
from two, at least, credible witnesses in the community, one being assistant superintendent, another a principal in the school, plus numerous law enforcement officers who witnessed the individual at the scene. There would be juvenile officers who witnessed the...
would be. Were they there? Did they testify?
At the juvenile hearing? Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. All of them would testify to what they witnessed at the time as to intent, which I think is the judge's questions.
What we're getting to is the certification issue involves weighing many different factors. In many instances, someone who brings a gun to school and shoots certainly would be certified as an adult. There are some instances where they are not, looking at the age and looking at the situation, looking at the intent and balancing all those factors. How do we go back and figure out what that would have been at this time, given that, in fact, he did have counsel who seemed to think his role was a counselor and to help him get this out as opposed to acting as defense counsel?
Right. Well, the facts, you know, would not have been changed. I don't think, no matter who the defense counsel would have been, as to what occurred, and perhaps would not have changed as to the reasons of their occurrence. The juvenile hearing took place, and he was certified, and there's no allegations by the relator that the order, the form of the order, in any way does not meet the requisite guidelines under the statute.
Oh, I thought he said there were reasons not given adequately by the trial court judge.
I don't know that he's argued that the reasons are inadequate.
The certification order reasons you were referring to, but
right.
But he is saying the trial court and the circuit court in reviewing the certification order failed to give reasons which you need to give when you're looking at...
Right.
Okay. And so two different orders. I'm sorry. But on the abuse of discretion standard, which it appears to me that that's really what we're here on, because of the method or the device that was used in objecting to the information, the evidence that was presented to Judge Moten in this matter was given in two separate hearings before the court. Judge Moten allowed the relator to go and take depositions about everything that happened at the juvenile court level. Judge Moten then allowed the relator to present that evidence and argue what objections and what evidence might have been presented that should have, you know, that should have been and wasn't. And Judge Moten considered all of those items as to whether or not he detailed them on making a ruling on an objection to information. I don't know that there's
but in
that
effect,
same level of,
is that required?
No.
But if we're in effect doing a post-conviction, we're ruling on the effective assistance of counsel, the context in which we usually do that is in a post-conviction motion, and we require a detail so we can review what the rationale the court gave and decide if it was an abuse of discretion or not. I understand why you make a good argument that it shouldn't be done in this context, but given that it was, how do we review it where we don't have that same kind of detail we always otherwise require?
And it's one of the reasons that the procedural issues and the substantive issues are so closely tied in this case. But and one of the reasons I suggest to this court that they adopt the Justice Donnelly's dissent. But my suggestion is that typically this is a post-conviction relief issue, and there must be prejudice before that to happen. In this case, I concede that there actually is prejudice if a juvenile is certified incorrectly right then, which is why I believe that now is the appropriate time. The Court of Appeals is the appropriate place, not another sitting circuit judge to hear an objection to the information. But back to the essential question of what is the substantive issue in this case, and that is, should the judge have granted this objection? The answer is no, because he obtained jurisdiction upon a valid judge's order out of the juvenile court. And there was no evidence presented that convinced Judge Moten that there would be a different outcome at the juvenile hearing, which really is the point in this case, is was he prejudiced by any shortfallings or any act of misfeasance or malfeasance by his former counsel? And if he was not prejudiced by those acts, then there can be no ineffective assistance of counsel.
You would, of course, agree that the certification hearing was really a high-stakes proceeding for this young
man.
Because the difference is, if he stays in the juvenile system, he goes through whatever DYS has available or other programming and the court's control over him does not last for as long as, say, a criminal sentence in a penitentiary.
Absolutely, I would agree that it has dramatic consequences. One of the things that happened in the hearing before Judge Moten on the objection to the information is there was evidence presented from the stand from a gentleman from Boys and Girls Town, and the judge asked the gentleman if there would be the opportunity for Boys and Girls Town to receive this this defendant should he be convicted under the dual jurisdictional program. And I think that was important both to the judge and perhaps important to the defense counsel that was representing him at the previous hearing. And the reason I say that is he actually went and investigated options under the dual jurisdictional sentencing program. And
that's exactly what would happen to him if he was convicted under the adult system.
Correct.
He'd go to Montgomery City.
And I think that was important to Judge Moten, and the transcript, I think, would support that. So,
but under dual jurisdiction, then after the juvenile phase of his punishment is completed, then he goes into the adult system.
Correct.
But if he stays in the juvenile system, not being certified, his time in the system lasts until age 21.
Correct.
And so up to 21. Yes. And so this is indeed a very high stakes proceeding when you're talking about that hearing, certification hearing.
It is high stakes. The last point kind of on that same vein and in response maybe to Justice Limbaugh's statements earlier, Judge Crawford had been on the bench for a long time and had heard numerous juvenile cases. The standard, one of the things that is complained about in the relator's petition is that perhaps his former counsel did not know the legal standard to apply in the hearing and felt that all of the factors listed in the statute 211 were all equally important as opposed to the nature of the crime being of primary importance.
I guess his testimony was that he didn't know anything.
I think that's a fair characterization, that is perhaps the statements made. Justice Limbaugh's point, though, this was the allegations of the crime are extremely important and extremely.
So you don't really need effective assistance as long as the judge knows the law, he'll just figure it out. Is that what you're saying?
I am not saying that. I think what I'm saying is, in this particular circumstance, without having the benefit of being inside of the former counsel's mind, I think that his thought was that cooperation, given the serious nature of the crime.
It's not cooperation. Just say, come on, who were you gunning for, kid?
Well, I'm not suggesting that perhaps I would have used that same technique, but it is, and really to the point of the issue is whether or not it would alter the outcome. And I really think that the end analysis is equally as important. To close, if I might, I would ask that I would suggest to this court that Judge Moten did not abuse his discretion on the substantive issue.
The outcome is not necessarily guilt or innocence. The outcome is being certified as a juvenile or as an adult. That's the outcome sought.
Correct. And I think that was the outcome that Judge Moten believed would not be changed if he were to have granted the objection to the information. I do not believe there was any abuse of discretion by Judge Moten. I do would basically implore this court that equally as important is the procedural issues for future juveniles who are wishing to challenge a certification order from a juvenile court and to clarify perhaps the device in which it is appropriate to do so. And I think now is the time, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to argue.
How, if we were to take you up on your invitation to say the appropriate way to review it is to immediately seek a writ upon certification, and if the deficiency is not on the face of the certification by failing to give reasons and so forth, but is the lack of effective assistance, which the various cases have said is required, do we then have to appoint a master? How do we figure out where it's effective? Could that be why prior courts have said the circuit court should do it, or what would be your alternative forum?
Excellent question. And I this is my first experience in arguing a writ, an extraordinary writ of prohibition. One of the things that I learned in this process is many things that are outside the record, what's typically the record on appeal when you're when you take an extraordinary writ of prohibition up to a court, can become can be attached as part of your extraordinary writ. So my suggestion would be most of the items that were presented to Judge Moten at the hearing on the objection to the information could be depositions, for instance. Could
but
be taken
you would have us act as a finder of fact.
I think that on the extraordinary writ on this type of case, I think that it would there would have to be a finding of fact as to whether ineffective assistance of counsel was provided at the juvenile court hearing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Let's see, if you have ineffective assistance of counsel, then it's expected that the ineffective counsel is going to bring a writ to deal with this issue?
Well, I think
I'm throwing it out there as a question. You did a writ.
It's a very unique set of circumstances because usually there will the attorney who starts out with the case will most likely finish the case through to its final disposition. That didn't happen here. But if I could, Your Honors, the court has seemed to express and ask me about prejudice. If I could, let's go back. It seems that the court acknowledges, and perhaps I'm being too presumptuous, that there was, that the first prong has been met. Well, if you have an attorney that knows the law, then he can develop a strategy based on an appropriate understanding of the law. So he can address the seriousness of the offense. He can cross the juvenile officer more vigorously. He can ask the juvenile officer what options she considered. He could have excluded inadmissible and irrelevant testimony. Could have put on Sue Kidd from DYS, who would have absolutely refuted April Polk's testimony. April Polk said that the boy would be back in the community within a year. Sue Kidd's testimony absolutely refutes that. And not only does it refute that, there's something that's even more important there. In any juvenile hearing, be it delinquency certification, abuse and neglect, the weight of the juvenile officer's testimony is given great weight. Once I put Sue Kidd on the stand and show that April Foltz was absolutely wrong, it not only refutes her testimony about DYS, it undermines her credibility on other regards, particularly the boy's sophistication and maturity. In fact, the attorney would have elicited specific testimony from Dr. Wisman, this boy is not dangerous. He did something dangerous, but he's not dangerous. Doing something dangerous and being dangerous are not necessarily the same thing. He would have elicited testimony from Dr. Wisman that this boy had been rehabilitated. Now, in addition to this, I have tried to show this court, perhaps I'm being immodest, I think I would be an effective attorney, and I would present evidence and wanted to show this court what evidence I would present. I would present Dr. Donna Bishop, who would get up on the stand and present overwhelming and probably uncontroverted testimony. But not only does certification not protect the community, it in fact endangers the community because it makes the boy more likely to reoffend the state.
So you made that offer of proof about the scientific data or information about a child of 13 or 14, and that was denied by the judge. You could not present evidence in that area.
I was not allowed to present Dr. Bishop's. That's my option. I was not allowed to put her on the stand. And finally, I would present Ben Silver. And I believe all that evidence addresses the factors for the judge to offer.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.